Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King,
reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace, bliss, amen. It's lovely to be with you this morning. Wasn't sure if Ram was going to allow it, but I'm very glad that he did. We have a new vision, a new Cross and Lotus Journal out for September 2015. I'd like to read from my dear friends. We have all had moods, feeling high or low, or any number of feeling states. In our life with God, there are also moods, but of a different nature. In our oneness with God, the divine life may take on a myriad expressions. The difference between divine moods and our human nature is that, when identified with the ego nature, moods we experience create further attachment to the ego. If you feel happy, you are thinking about your surroundings and find reasons to be happy. If you feel sad, you identify with sadness, and your entire consciousness is saturated with it. Divine moods express themselves through you, and while they are powerful feelings, they definitely feel that it is God Himself who is moving through you, and there is always a part of you that is not bound by the mood, even though you feel it fully. This is a subtle distinction, but when you experience it, the difference is very clear. Many times I have had God's compassionate grief express itself through me. It is usually in relationship to a grief that someone else is going through. But there have been times when God has grieved for this world through me without reference to any individual. Rather, it is an outpouring of compassionate love for the pain that is suffered in this world. At other times, God's great joy wells up in me in connection with the universal self, the bliss of His being expressed throughout all creation in Christ consciousness. Or it can be His unbearable tenderness moving through me at the incredible beauty that is found in His omniscience. Every mood found in human expression is only a pale reflection of what is experienced through the Divine Mother's heart and mind. A particular divine mood has been with me all of this calendar year. I have felt that death has been stalking me, death to things of the world, a feeling of finality and endings. Having gone through the death of the ego and its many throes, I am familiar with what it means to die to the things of this world. This mood that God is expressing through me is different than any of those previous states of consciousness. This feeling is definitely signaling the end of a stage of life. It is as if God has gone on hiatus in this form. When I am with devotees, God expresses Himself as much as He has in the past. I feel His bliss and joy in doing so. However, I am feeling more and more reclusive. Deep within, I feel such stillness, an inner equilibrium that has no impetus for outer motion. In the most recent precepta lessons from Yogananda for our Bellingham Center, Master writes that you should not live life mechanically. Certainly, discipline and accomplishing goals in life is a great attribute to have. However, what you do must have life to it. To be mechanical only in your habits leads to death of the soul. In leading a life of surrender to God, it will happen that you may not know what lies in the future as God takes you step by step. I find myself in just such a stage, knowing not what will come. My commitment to God and Guru and being a minister for God is to teach the truth as God reveals it through me, to live the life with integrity, and to serve all devotees as He directs me. This I have done, this I will continue to do. In order to do this, I must be free to act according to His will. Knowing that I cannot act mechanically, and knowing not where He is taking me in this adventure, makes me know that I know nothing other than what He is giving me, and right now He is in hiatus. This hiatus is not the absence of God, far from it. This human form strains daily to be an adequate conduit for all the power and grace that He passes through it. Day to day is a challenge just to remain active to the degree that I do in this world. His fire burns in me day and night, and His bless flares from this form out into all space. However, I feel He may change His mode of expression in this form, and that the form may look different than it has in the past years. What these changes may be is uncertain, as God has offered some ideas, but nothing solid has evolved of itself yet. During his later years, Master went to the desert retreat for more often. Mother talked of going into seclusion in order to write. Perhaps this new stage will have more time in solitude. Certainly in this last year, I have traveled less to the centers, and there may come a time when new teachers will come forward to bring their light of God more greatly into this world. When Mother asked me to teach, she said I should not speak of philosophy only, but I should relate my own experiences. While God is particular about what experiences He relates through this form, I have always done as my Guru has asked, and I continue this tradition even now by relating to you in real time what God is doing in this form. My love for God, Gurus, and being in service to all sincere seekers remains undiminished. Surely He will guide me in ways that will be for the highest good of all concerned. For this is my prayer to Him. Since writing this, more details, of course, have come forward about what God has planned. And taking me to the desert, Carla and I to the desert, seems to be the first thing on the scheduled trip. And so He's directed us to get an RV vehicle in which we can live on the road and take a trip down through Utah and the various canyons that are there, and then down into southwest United States in order to be in the desert there. And I feel this yearning to get out into the open space of desert, to feel the expansiveness of it, the purity of it. It is perhaps an odd association, but it feels very clean to me to be out in the desert, even though it's filled with dust and sand and so on. Nevertheless, that is the feeling that I have for it. And what God has in mind there, I don't know, only that I should be there, that my spirit, my soul should expand out into that atmosphere, and that there is, I'm sure, something that He has there for me. A life of surrender is really something else. Most of us plan our days, plan our life, think about things that we have to do, and that we want to accomplish, and this is natural. This is natural. But as you attune yourself with the divine consciousness, God will take you on a great adventure. Now, sometimes this does not mean you leave your home. I remember when I worked at a particular agency for 13 years, and various people would come and they would work there for some time and then leave, and then they would come back to visit. And they would look at me and they'd say, "Are you still here?" And I would think to myself, "Yes, am I still here?" And I would run through, "God, is this where you meant me to be?" I was doing other kinds of work as well, but this seemed to be the mainstay at the time. And every time I checked in, it was an absolute yes. Stay right where you are. Don't go anyplace else. And that was the last paying job, you might say, that I had. And when it came time, I had no idea. I thought that probably the next stage is I would be more and more in private practice, both in my counseling and in my mediation business, both of which I had at the time. And instead, being down at Prem's house, Prem and Sheila's in San Diego, and while they were playing this wonderful chant to God, it came to me so powerfully, and I'd never had the thought before. And God said, "Definitely leave this job, leave everything of this world, and come and serve me only." And so I had no fear around it, but I also didn't know how it was all going to operate. What would I do to sustain myself? How would this operate? I had no idea whatsoever, but I felt entirely and completely trusting in God. And so I started out on this last adventure, having fulfilled God's purpose, I suppose, for being in this world up until that point, and started into a new life. And then the next big stage came when God directed me to remain a year in silence and seclusion. Now, before that came to me, I had never spent an entire day in silence, much less an entire year. But out came his command, and I just felt such tremendous bliss in thinking about it. And so God arranged everything, and I ended up being at Cloud Mountain in an ideal situation where I had this little cabin. Everybody from the group would come once a month and would chant Ram Nam and be in silence for the day. And then toward the end of that year, we had an entire weekend there. And this is the way that it went. And each and every day was meant to teach me how to surrender to God more and more completely. It's one thing to surrender our actions to Him and to leave our lives open to His influence. But then we go through the various internal states. And as we go deeper into meditation, we come to those places where we grab hold. We, because of some desire nature or some fear, we have difficulty letting go and letting God take us into the next stage. It's absolutely critical that we meet these different oppositional forces, and they can stir up the deepest state of fear, the deepest desire nature in us, things that we did not even know existed, but surely they did, for something does not come from nothing. It's been there, but now it's being revealed. And so we stick with our meditation. We keep going deeper. We work through whatever it is that has come up. And when you get into the third body, the causal body, it becomes very subtle. You realize every single thought that you have is a creation. And if it is a thought based in ignorance, something that is not directed from God, then you are giving creative power to that thought. And that is why it is absolutely necessary for us to get a handle on our thoughts. Now, through our Kriya meditation and going deeper into our oneness with God, by chanting God's name, by divinely loving Him and serving Him in all forms, you see, we are given all of these techniques in order to purify the mind. And yet, as we purify the mind, we still come up against these obstacles. So at the very end, you are letting go of yourself and any semblance of who and what you think yourself to be. Because it's pure ego consciousness, therefore it has to go. And you release yourself, not once but many times, into the great ocean of consciousness. And you release yourself, you dissolve yourself. I say you dissolve yourself, and yet it is pure grace because the ego cannot transcend the ego. The ego cannot orchestrate, nor can it make any of this happen. It can simply surrender itself to God. And when you get to that state, you feel yourself dissolving, you feel yourself becoming a nothing. And there was a stage that I went through this mystical crucifixion, in which I went into the nothingness of God. Now, in the nothingness of God, you don't feel the bliss of God. You don't feel the allness of God. You feel absolutely blank. And I want to make this distinction about what I was speaking about, this hiatus in God and this nothingness of God. In this nothingness of God, there is no presence of God, but that's not my state as it is. I feel the fullness of God. I feel the allness of God. And yet, I don't feel Him expressing Himself outwardly very easily. I sit in my meditation chair at home, and like a great geyser, the bliss goes up through the spine and through to the top of the head, and from the top of the head out into all space. And I barely feel that I have an outline of a body. That's how it feels, just an idea of a body, just an idea of any semblance of self, and sometimes that completely disappears as I merge into that all consciousness. And so through these experiences, and as I was saying before, I went through this nothingness of God. And somebody said, I don't feel like you're here. And I said, it just came out of me spontaneously. I said, I'm dead. And I noticed in myself, I had absolutely no feeling about it. No thought about it, that I should say such a thing. It was startling, or I thought it should be startling to me, but it wasn't. And so I was in this state of nothingness, and it's something that then you gradually come out of. And as you do, God reanimates you. But you see, the ego and the ego mind hangs on in a myriad of ways. There are so many ways, so many depths, in which it hangs on into a state of separation. So that wasn't the end of the journey. That was just simply a stage that I went through, going through the nothingness of God. And then there were so many other stages, but eventually getting into that rarefied state where you are letting go of any semblance of yourself at all and merging into God, doing it again and again and again, until finally that little bubble dissolves, the little bubble of self, the little bubble of I. And even when that bubble is reanimated, because you have to have some sense of I in order to operate in this world, but now it is God. We talked about at the retreat the revelations. And first there was revelations means to reveal, means to unseal, and that there is the unsealing on the seven different centers. And that means that those centers become activated where they were sealed before, because we are living in a state of ignorance. And those various states of consciousness, the purity of them, the God nature in them, have become veiled to us, so to speak. They become sealed. So there's an unsealing. And now suddenly, the seven stars, the seven candlesticks, the seven churches, it's all talking about these seven centers. And there is a God-man who is seen, who has the seven candlesticks, and they're lit up. That means that the God self has now become activated, and it has complete self-mastery of these seven different levels. And then the next stage is you are sealed in heaven. Now, this seems strange after you've gone through the unsealing, but this describes that as the consciousness is released and is fully illumined in all of these different seven stages of consciousness within your being, now they are being sealed, but they are being sealed unto God. They are being merged unto God. They are being activated with God's energy. So now, when you have this ego consciousness, you feel that it's God who's activating you through the ego consciousness. You act in this world, you speak in this world, you do in this world as anybody else does. But it's completely different. It's God who's flowing through you, thinking through you, feeling through you, doing everything through you. And you're conscious of it, you're aware of it. And so many of the same things that you did before, you now do. But you know that it is God that is moving through you. There's no sense of separation. There's no sense that you and God are different. So this is a tremendous thing. And this is the sealing of the seven churches inside of you. And it's a gradual process. This is not something that happens overnight. But gradually, gradually, all the seven seals get activated. Now it is God alone who inhabits you, who thinks through you, who does everything through you. This is a wonderful state and something that is really impossible to describe in the sense that there are really no adequate words for it. Words are just symbolic representations of ideas and thoughts and experiences. But it must be a shared experience in order for the words to really relate. So you have to have that shared experience. And when you do, it takes you beyond all thought, all words. So now God is alone operating in and through you. You take one step forward, but you don't necessarily know what the next step is. He's in charge. He's in control. Now, he may give you a vision of what is to come. That is his will as well. He may be leading you like a blind man where you take God's arm and he guides and directs you, and there's absolutely no knowledge of the things around you. One time, Master Mahashaya was describing various mathematical formulas to Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna had to ask, and Master Mahashaya got so far through it, and Ramakrishna finally said, stop, stop, stop. He says, you're making my head hurt. It feels like it's about ready to burst. And you realize that as God moves through your brain, you realize all the various stages that you have in your brain. You can feel the life energy flowing into the frontal lobes, and that represents a particular kind of way of thinking, a logical processing, connecting things together. That is the reasoning mind, what is called the buddhi. But then God comes and he illuminates the buddhi. Now suddenly it's lit up with God's intelligence. You feel it coming right through the back of your medulla, and it comes right in through to the frontal lobes. And it's God who's thinking through you. And you don't really have any thoughts of your own. In a sense, it feels quite familiar, but you absolutely realize that this thinking is coming from someplace greater. And so he's able to operate through you in any aspect of the brain. But he has particular purposes he wants to fulfill at different times. And so he withdraws from a particular part of your brain. Ramakrishna wasn't able to think in mathematical formulas, and when he tried to get his mind oriented that way, it created a tremendous pain. I'm well aware of this. There is a time when I wasn't able to do even simple mathematics. I would look at my checkbook. I would try to balance it. I had money in the account, but I couldn't even bring myself to write a check. And I asked Carla if she would help me with it. It felt like I was a little child. It was very humbling because I couldn't do something that would be absolutely simple. Any young person who had an adequate mind would be able to do such a thing, but I found it impossible. And there have been many times like that where God will operate in one part of my brain, but it is not operating in another part, and it just simply doesn't function because he has his whole will running in another way. At the very top of your head is very sensitive nerve cluster there. And it's wonderful. It's beautiful. This represents the all-consciousness of God. It can be called the crown chakra or the Sahasrara, various names it can go by. When you see kings, and what do kings have? Kings wear a crown, and they have a scepter. Now, the scepter is a long stick, and the stick represents the spine. And it represents, at one time in this world, someone who was a head of state would have been a realized being. When you look at the crowns from Egypt, you see there that the serpent comes right out of the third eye point. And what that symbolizes is that this kundalini force, this serpent force, has been raised all the way up and is now centered at the state of Christ consciousness. This is a realized master. And it allows him to be able to rule from a point of wisdom. And he has complete self-mastery of all the various stages of consciousness in his own spine and brain. Now, when you see the crown represents this 1,000-petal lotus, or from Revelations, 1,000 years of peace. And it should represent that the individual has raised their consciousness and is now operating out of that 1,000-petal lotus, the crown chakra. And at various times, it will take on different experiences for you. Sometimes it'll feel like a heavy hat is sitting on top of your head. At other times, it'll be quite painful. It'll be this kundalini force that will be raised up to the crown chakra, and it will feel like sparks. It will feel like needles all through your head. And this is the crown of thorns that Jesus wore that was said to be fashioned by the Roman guards, and they took this crown of thorns and they pressed it down hard on his head, and he was bleeding as a result. And it feels very much like that when this kundalini force is rising up. Now, it's not God trying to hurt you, and it's certainly not God trying to harm you. It's simply that as these forces become activated, your nervous system is not yet ready for it all. And the only way to make it ready is for these energies to flow through you. And as they flow up through you, they will meet different obstacles along the way. Sometimes your nervous system is not yet ready for it. But as this energy comes up, it's very much like muscles that are being exercised. You strain and you stress a muscle in order to signal to the body to send more blood, to build more muscles in that area, and in that way you get stronger. And in exactly the same way, your nervous system gets stronger as God stresses and strains it, sending this divine energy up from the base of your spine all the way up through your spine and into the top of your head. Doesn't always get there right away. You'll meet obstacles. The other thing it does is each one of your chakras, as they are called, along your spine, they have a positive and a negative. And this tremendous divine energy rises up. And it'll activate both the positive and the negative, the good, the bad thief on either side. And the good thief will want to continue up, going towards God, but the bad thief will get derisive. It'll activate all the negativity that you have associated with that center. And these are your temptations. These are the things that come up to you that you must be able to fight through. Now, it is not just you. God's grace, God's will is with you. So as you chant God's name, as you surrender to Him, as you love Him, as you keep your total and complete focus on Him, His grace enables you to be able to meet and surpass those challenges. Now, if those things get activated and you don't make it, you go with that bad thief. The Last Temptation of Christ was a tremendous book. Nikos Kazantzakis' mother said he is a fully realized soul, and both his book about St. Francis and about the Last Temptation show what a tremendously realized being this was. But Jesus was up on the cross, as the novel goes, of Kazantzakis' The Last Temptation of Christ. He's up on the cross, and he's thinking to himself, I wish I had just led a regular life. I just wish that I had gotten married, had children. Look at, following God's will has taken me all the way to this place, and where am I at? I'm nailed to a cross. What's this all about? I don't like it. I don't like it. Well, because individuals have free will, suddenly the way opened up, and Jesus got down off the cross. It's as if all time stopped, and he walked away. He didn't want any part of it. And as he walked away, he eventually came to a village, and he met a woman, and they became married, and he had children, and he took up carpentry again. He led the normal life that he had been wondering about and thinking that might have been the better thing for him to do. Can you imagine such a thing? Can you imagine Jesus having the free will to do this, allowing God allowing him to go with that free will? It's a very, very interesting idea. And eventually, as he lived his life out in this way, he heard cries of the world, cries of the pain of people who were in, particularly in spiritual pain. And suddenly it came to him, that's why I was up on that cross. Not just for myself, but for this world as well. And finally he came to the conclusion, it was a hard thing for him to do. That's what I was intended to do. And as wonderful and as lovely as the rest of this life is, it's not my life. It's not my life. And he surrendered himself in that moment. Now, as the biblical story goes, that surrender came in the Garden of Gethsemane. But Kazantzakis had it in the middle of this crucifixion. And that's right as well. Because you face very many things, even once you're up on that cross, not a cross of wood, but a cross of this body, ascending up the spinal stairway. And so Jesus went back. He went back up voluntarily onto that cross, and he completed. And then he said, it is finished. It is complete. And it was what he had come to do. Now all of us, our karma will look a little different. What we're here to do will be different. And yet, what is similar, what is common to us all, is that in order to follow the Christ, in order to pick up our cross and follow Him, we must ascend up this spinal stairway. Our own temptations, our own things that we have to face, they will be individual to us. And each and every one of us will come to that point where we will think, wouldn't it be better just to crawl down off of this cross and slink away someplace and live a life of obscurity. Why am I doing this? Mother said she oftentimes thought, what in the world have I got myself into, having gone through these experiences? It's a natural thing to have happen. But unless and until you come to that point where you will surrender yourself, it has to be all the way. Nothing else can suffice, because surrender is the surrender of the ego. And it is the ego that keeps you in separation from God. And if you cannot or you will not surrender the ego, then you cannot realize God. The two go inextricably hand in hand. Because as long as you don't surrender, that means the ego is hanging on. As long as the ego is hanging on, you cannot express the fullness of God. So you see how exacting, you see how refined this is. In the Vedas, it is called the razor's edge. So thin is it to walk upon. Now, we don't need to be afraid of that. We don't need to be afraid of this path. Not at all, because it leads us to freedom. Perfect freedom. And it's the most wonderful thing when we enter into that state. So we should not think that this is something that some torture that God has designed for us. No, this is the way out. This is the way out. I wanted to read you something. I came across this booklet in Mother's library. I have so many wonderful things from it. And these are called Stories of Master. And some of them were related later in a published book. But there's many things here that are talked about that they edited out. One of them was Kamala. Many of us are familiar with Kamala from a couple of wonderful books that she wrote about her time with Master. But Master said, look at that girl, Kamala. For 27 years, she has been in the work. She is very near freedom. After she had been a long time with me, she should, and she would be safe. It is a little past karma she had to work out. I picked her husband myself. What a wonderful soul he is, the true sannyasi. But she is the only one I told to get married. Another said he was leaving to get married. He said, it's poorly typewritten, so. No matter where I am, I will always follow you and meditate. I said, you won't, because your place is here. If you give in to evil, you will forget good. But he left, and pretty soon he forgot his resolution to meditate and be loyal, because evil has its power, and if we side with it, it will hold us. Dorothy Taylor was reading from the Gita manuscript about attaining oneness with God. Master writes that having reached this state, maybe I shouldn't read it because the typing here is pretty blurry. So anyway, they go on to say that in the Gita, that you can merge and become one with God, and then a devotee begins saying, well, you have said that you are the wave and you become the ocean, therefore you are God. And he keeps trying to pin Master down, and Master won't let him. And so back and forth they go. And Master finally says, if someone says they are God, they are not. And if they say they are not God, then they are not. So you feel, because it can't be the ego who enters in through that final state. It has to be a complete and total surrender that you come to at that point. And if the ego is completely gone, if it is completely surrendered, then who is there left to say that I have become this or I have become that? You simply don't have it any longer. It is God who is now manifesting. Now, if God chooses to say it, he might say it. In our affirmation of prayer, we say, I and God are one. And it's a good thing. We should try to feel that. We should try to know where it is, that that is the absolute truth. But it can't be a statement of truth until we have gone through all of these seven churches, seven candlesticks, seven powers, until they have become unsealed, and we have realized that they're all activated inside of us. And then we go through the next stage, and they all become sealed with God, one with God. And now there is only He, and imperfect trust, imperfect love, imperfect surrender, you know that there is only one. This is the most tremendous path that we have been put upon. As Mother said, those who are drawn to this path, they are in the final mile. And that means we each and every one of us have the capacity for going all the way to God. We really do. These are the highest teachings, the purest teachings. What Master brought, what Mother brought, what a guru lineage brought, what Papa brought and Swamiji brought, pure teachings of God. And therefore, they represent that path that is most straight, most direct, in order to achieve oneness with God. We don't have a lot of form. We don't have a lot of ritual. Try to keep it at a minimum. When you set up your altar, if you want to put up some pictures and some candles and incense, that's all wonderful. And you have your meditation blanket made of wool or of silk, and you sit on that, and you create a place that is charged with your meditation vibration. But very soon you close your eyes. And then you put your attention here at the ajna. And you put your whole attention there, and you see, that's the only ritual that we need. That's the only form that we need. And we think of God. We put our whole attention upon Him. We can do this any place or any time. Master used to test himself. He used to go into a busy downtown area, and he would stand there, right on the sidewalk, and he would close his eyes, and he would test himself to see if he